States against Edwards. Mr. Bautista.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Andrew Bautista, pro bono counsel for Anthony Edwards. With the Court's permission, I'd like to start with our intricately related evidence arguments.
Well, I want to ask you about this doctrine about staleness of Miranda warnings.
Okay, start with that. Although this circuit hasn't articulated many cases, at least not in many years, about the staleness of Miranda warnings, other circuits have taken a look at it.
What does it mean?
It means that the warning, once originally given, will eventually dissipate and
what
has to be readvised.
Kind of like invisible ink?
No,
it's forgotten? Is that the idea?
I think it gets to the idea that it's not fresh in
I don't like that metaphor, fresh. Stale, dissipate. It's either forgotten or it's not forgotten. If it's forgotten, then. But if it's not forgotten, why is it stale?
I think it covers more than just forgetting.
But I know it covers more. That's what bothers me. What does it cover more?
Well, I think it also covers acts that occur after that time that lead one to believe that one.
What did I didn't hear access?
Well,
did you say access?
I said acts, A-C-T-S.
Oh, acts, I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Acts
are incidents that occur that would lead a person not to believe that they continue to have these rights or continue to have the ability to waive these rights.
That's not staleness. I mean, you could say, we gave you the Miranda warning, but by the way, we don't give those anymore. The Supreme Court should have overruled Miranda, so we're just not giving it to you, so... You don't mean that, do you?
No, that's not what I mean. I would mean
what
that
acts are you talking about then?
I would events such as a defendant who is being questioned again and doesn't realize that he can, at this time, waive the Miranda, that he hasn't waived them once and for all, that these rights still exist, and then if he does not want to answer any more questions, he can invoke his rights.
But that, it seems to me you can come at that in two ways. One of them is that there's a gap in the original set of warnings that are given, and perhaps a gap in these waiver forms that people sign. Or you're just saying, even though you've signed and waived and everything, you tell the people, you tell the officers the second time around, you remember all this stuff that you did 30 minutes ago, maybe somehow the impact of the rights has disappeared from your mind and you are now misunderstanding the scope. But I've never seen the Supreme Court say that you have to keep giving people renewed lectures about Miranda you could forget even in the course of one interrogation, it seems to me. I'm not sure that the fact that this was broken up into two makes any difference. If the fact that you can always change your mind isn't on the waiver form to begin with, that's really your argument. It's not that there was a 30-minute gap.
I agree, Your Honors, that I cannot cite U.S. Supreme Court precedent yet on this.
No, because there isn't anything.
So the question would be, what would be the distinction between a continuous interrogation where somebody is no longer familiar with their rights and a case where there's been a break?
Yeah, it seems to me there's a bigger risk, actually, in the continuous interrogation because you're rolling along, you're talking to them, time has gone by, and now you're in the habit of answering questions, and you might forget that you can all of a sudden pull back and say, I've decided to stop talking to you. Seems to me if you've had 30 minutes to reflect on it, you might be much more likely to recognize that.
I agree that long, continuous, and perhaps relays in a Miranda might reach to a point where a court could conclude that there might need to be a Miranda rewarning.
But, the problem that I had with your case was really not just with this. It was the record. The officer doesn't just go in and start talking again. He goes in. He's got the form in his hands. He reminds Mr. Edwards that he's just done this. Mr. Edwards says yes. He remembers. And then they start. That's not an attractive record for your position.
I agree, Your Honors, that there was a refresher to the extent that he re-showed the warnings and asked him, do you remember this? But there was no going through it once and again. And I would submit that at this point it was required to reread through the warnings and make sure that the defendant still understood the warnings and that he had the option to waive them again.
Well, I had a point of clarification to ask you about with respect to the topic you wanted to start with, the prior crimes. As I read this record, but you can correct me if I'm wrong, the district court decides at the guilt phase, the judge says, all right, I'm going to allow the government to introduce this evidence on a very limited basis, though. And he says, you can't talk about the 50 times. You know, you have to really restrict what comes in, and with the possible exception of the impeachment evidence that the government alludes to in footnote 17 of its brief, it seems that that's what happens at the guilt stage. And then at the sentencing stage, we have a whole different set of rules anyway, so I don't want to think about what happened right now at the sentencing stage. In this limited sense, it's hard for me to see why, in light of Mr. Edwards' position on the facts of the case, that little bit couldn't come in.
The judge kept out the exact number of times. So
The 50 was... And it's a significant restriction. I'm thinking to myself, if the judge just says, yes, we've had prior encounters, that's one thing. We did it 50 times is quite another.
I agree, Your Honor. To the extent the judge limited the numbers, because the 50 number was extremely prejudicial, but I believe that a lot more evidence still came in about this being a typical routine, about calling him a drug dealer, a crack addict, a source and a supplier. Although that doesn't give an exact number, it leads to the inference that he is who he is, and thus he committed this crime because of his propensity to do such crimes.
Even if you're right that it was erroneous to admit even that limited bit of evidence, why wouldn't this be harmless error on this record?
Well, I would preface my arguments by saying it's notable that the court that the government did not raise a harmless error argument.
Yeah, but we have an obligation to think about that.
Correct, Your Honors. And I would think that the weighing the prejudice of this type of evidence, the propensity evidence, against the evidence that was brought in, that one could not say that a reasonable juror would not have convicted if the evidence of the prior times was not submitted. I don't believe in the weighing of the evidence the government could fulfill its burden of showing that beyond a reasonable doubt that the jury wouldn't have convicted.
This is with like the bags of crack falling out of his legs and stuff. I mean, I would also
add the cumulative error from the other charges, things that we've read, things that we've brought, that together that might also have weighed into the harmless error analysis. I'd like to also make sure I address the sentencing issues. I believe it's that the government did not fulfill its burden on the sentencing enhancements, and that there was a four-level enhancement because of this. Starting with the cash conversion, it is the government's burden to prove a connection between this particular currency and a drug transaction, and there was nothing brought into the record at the sentencing making that direct connection.
Is there any way on this record you can get, I'm going to ask the government this question too, you can get to the range at least 35 grams but less than 50 grams of cocaine base without taking that money and converting it into a drug equivalent?
if you just take the 50 transactions, if you do that addition, that does not get you over 35.
You take the drugs you found on him.
Correct.
Plus the 50 transactions.
Correct. That will still not put you over 35, according to my calculations, but I can double check.
And what about this? It's a little vague, but what about this evidence that Edwards was selling crack for 3 months to customers other than Beagle?
The government never fulfilled its burden to show that that is related evidence under the sentencing guidelines, that it's part of a common scheme. So I don't think there is anything in the evidence to show that these alleged, sales to people outside of Beagle, and it's really not clear in the testimony that these people exist or where they are or when they occurred, that that's not sufficient evidence in order to support a judge's sentencing enhancement.
His only explanation for the $765 was unbelievable. So
The judge did find that his explanation was not credible. But
right.
I don't.
So if someone testifies as to something, and there are two alternatives, he testifies to one, and it's ridiculous. Then why can't the trier of fact believe the other?
Because I believe that does not negate the burden of the other side.
No,
if he had remained silent.
I don't understand you. He gets up and says, no, it wasn't drug money. I had, sold the Hope Diamond or something. And the judge says, that's ridiculous. Well, that only leaves one possibility.
Well, even if the judge then found that it was a drug transaction, the judge didn't make the further finding that it was a related drug transaction.
That's a separate point.
Okay. Just getting to that point of whether...
Your notion that somehow disbelief cannot support an inference of what actually happened, that doesn't make sense. No one thinks that way.
I understand your point, Your Honor.
I mean, it's one thing you don't have. If he doesn't testify, that's a different matter. The government has to put in some evidence. But if he gets up and gives some fantastic story and there's only one plausible alternative, it seems to me the trier of fact can believe the alternative.
I understand your point, Your Honor. I would still argue that his...
Were there other plausible alternatives that were discernible on this record?
He did not assert any other alternative, but I don't think that he stated was that unbelievable. I mean, there are oftentimes...
Yeah, but the judge didn't have to believe it once he believed. See, if he had said, well, I don't remember how I got the 765, it may have been that I sold my minivan. Okay, that's fine. That leaves open some lawful or, alternative, unrelated. But if he says, this is what happened, I sold it, I sold my minivan, that's how I got the money. He's excluded all the plausible alternatives. So if you don't believe him, he has no leg to stand on.
Yeah, if the judge found it was not credible and he excluded all other points, then we would fall back on the argument that there was no evidence that it was related. And if there are no questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Mr. Bautista. Mr. Ratcliffe.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Tom Ratcliffe. I represent the government in this case, as you know. I'd like to respond first on the issue of the intricately related evidence.
Why do you cling to that terrible cliche?
Intricately
related. It's such nonsense. Why don't you say what you mean rather than hiding behind a semantic fog like that?
Judge Posner, that is the issue that I was going to address. Neither the district court nor I nor anyone else had the benefit of your decision in the Taylor case.
Well, but
at the time that this
you defend your intricately related. You say we didn't overrule. I don't know how you overrule fog, right? I mean, you don't say we're not going to permit anybody to use this formula again.
No, that's correct, Judge.
What utility does it have?
I took up the issue that the defendant raised of intricately related evidence and whether it was the evidence in this case was properly admitted under that standard, because that's what the district court relied on. That's what I, in my initial motion, my pretrial motion, offered up as our primary reason for why we wanted this evidence in. As I said, we didn't have the benefit of Taylor at the time, but I argued alternatively in our pretrial motion that it also satisfied, as you indicate in the Taylor decision, almost every piece of evidence that is admitted or is offered as intricately related can also fit into one of the headings of Rule 404B's exceptions.
Into one of the headings in Rule 404B, it shouldn't come in.
Well, that's
so why
right.
don't we just forget about the fog and discuss the actual language of Rule 404?
Well, I would like you to back up one step and explain to what issue or issues do you think this evidence met the general relevancy standards, number one, and then whether it is withdrawn from the pool of evidence you're allowed to use because of Rule 404, or whether it comes back in under one of the exceptions of 404B.
Judge Wood, there were two reasons that the evidence was relevant. The evidence of the defendant's prior dealings with Mr. Beagle, the government's informant. One was Mr. Beagle, as you know, made a series of predictions about how this transaction was going to unfold.
Why is that relevant? I mean, you have in your brief the statement, well, this is how he knew that Mr. Edwards was going to pull his car into the alley. But I found that a little crazy because they were on the phone to each other. They were talking on the phone, so they could have been people who had just met over the phone an hour before, and if they're talking on the phone, he's saying, I'm pulling into the alley now. I mean, I don't know why we need more of an explanation.
Well, Your Honor, it wasn't just that he was pulling into the alley in the dark-colored Cadillac at the location that was predicted.
Yeah.
It was the fact that...
So what? I mean, it's the sale.
Well, Your Honor, it was one more piece as well. It was the fact that Mr. Beagle said, if I don't get out there right away, and in this case he didn't, then Willie, the person I know is Willie, who ends up being the defendant, is going to pull away. And Willie did pull away when there was a delay. So it was
and
not
why
just
is it? And your charge was sale of cocaine, right?
Possession with intent to distribute.
Possession with
Your
intent
Honor.
To distribute. So why
yes.
is the fact that Willie starts to pull away relevant to whether he possessed with intent to distribute cocaine?
It is.
This is not a search warrant case.
Correct. But as the defendant did at trial, and as the defendant continues to do in his brief, we anticipated and saw that the defendant would trash, essentially, Mr. Beagle and say, as he says in his brief, that he was an addict and inherently unreliable. So we knew, especially given the defendant's testimony at the suppression hearing, that he didn't even know anyone named Beagle and wasn't in that alley except to urinate.
But let's focus. I mean, boy, you stressed that in your brief. But are you saying that this evidence comes in because of the intent to distribute part? Or are you, what's
irrelevant? No, Your Honor.
But,
as I started to say before, and I realize I didn't finish, but there are two bases. One is it establishes the defendant's identity. It bolsters the informant, Mr. Beagle's, identity of that as Willie. That's the guy I know as Willie. This is how he does it, and I am reliable because I told the police all these things before, and even though I'm a crack addict, even though I'm a user, even though I've got my neck in a vice because of the conviction that I have, and even though I have a favorable plea agreement requiring me to testify truthfully,
we know all about that.
Trust
yeah.
me, Your Honor, or trust me, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I am correct in saying that is Willie. The second reason, Your Honor, other than the defendant's identity, is we believe, although it's not as compelling, I recognize, but it is still relevant because it does, these facts and the history of how this would play out does show a modus operandi of how this transaction would work, how the defendant on 50 prior occasions, he always, now the jury didn't hear, as you know.
I don't get this at all. You didn't charge him with conspiracy. You didn't charge him with 50 transactions. You didn't charge him with anything that made that relevant.
But, Your Honor, he raises the defense of, I just happened to be in the alley. Well, no.
And even if he just happened to be in the alley, if he was there and decides on the spur of the moment to sell crack to somebody else, he's violated the law, hasn't he?
Well, he has, Your Honor. But
sure, yes.
What we needed to be able to show was that the defendant had a history with the with
Why
Mr. Beagle.
Why did you have to show that?
In order to be able to prove, as I said, that Mr. Beagle's identification of Willie as the defendant was accurate, given all the baggage that Mr. Beagle, the informant slash defendant, came with. It did go to the identity issue.
All right. So you're going to settle on reliability of the identification. I'm troubled about this $765 and the vagueness. Would you agree that you can't get between 35 and 50 grams of crack without using the $765?
Correct, Your Honor. Okay. The 17 grams that were found on him plus the, if you add the 10 grams that the court came up with as a result of the 50 prior transactions for the bare minimum amount that Mr. Beagle said he purchased, 0.2 grams, that adds up to 27 grams.
So you have to have the conversion. And so what about Mr. Bautista's point that the $765 might have been from unrelated LSD sales that he was making or, you know, guns that he was running or any of a number of other shady dealings that he may have been having? What evidence tells us that this has to have been drug money and indeed drug money related to this course of conduct?
Your Honor, what tells us that is the defendant's extensive post-Miranda admissions that did not come in full until the sentencing hearing. They are summarized in the DEA 6 report that is attached as an exhibit in the appendix. But the defendant, who admits not only in his first interview that he does not have a job, but tells the probation department at the time the PSR is prepared that he doesn't have a job.
No, I understand that, but also, why does that answer my question that maybe he was selling guns on the side? I mean, maybe he was doing a completely unrelated, maybe he had two simultaneous but illegal businesses.
Your
why
Honor,
do we know that this $765 meets the relevant conduct criteria that the guidelines spell out?
Because the district court found, based on a preponderance of the evidence, that the defendant, who was unemployed and had this money and did admit to having sold crack for 8 or 9 months, that his explanation that he offered at trial when he was trying to get himself off the hook was, as was discussed earlier, this, I sold a van that's untraceable.
Of course. No, I have no problem that with that being preposterous. I mean, he was caught every which way on that explanation. No doubt about it. It's just that I feel that there needs to be some link between the $765 and the conduct for which he's being sentenced that meets the relevant conduct criteria under the guidelines. And it seems to me the link is, oh, it must have been this particular illegal conduct. You're just making an assumption at some point.
Well, the only illegal conduct that we know of is the defendant's admission to being a crack dealer for 8 or 9 months.
Right, because nobody ever asked. I mean, you know, he's challenging the fact that $765 is part of the relevant conduct.
Well, Your
and,
Honor.
And I'm not aware of a world in which there's only one way that you can violate the law and have shady income.
No, there's certainly a multitude
sure,
of ways.
When
you
live in that world either.
When he testified, would he have been subject to prosecution if he had instead of the minivan story he had said, well, I got the money from selling the gun or selling, you know, methamphetamine or something?
Judge Posner, he would have been subject to prosecution. I think it's highly unlikely that we would have done that,
I
but certainly
but
he was in jeopardy.
But it
yes,
it means that he wasn't in a position where it would have, where if there was another illegal source, he could have said so, and that would have gotten him, you know, would have reduced his sentence, right? Because you can see how if he were somehow given immunity for his other legal acts, it would be in his interest if there was an illegal source unrelated to the charges in this case to say, yeah, I got the money selling guns or doing this, but he couldn't do that because he would be incriminating himself.
At the time of trial, Your Honor, yes, he was at risk. However, he did have plenty of notice after the PSR was prepared, plenty of opportunity to come in and offer up an alternative explanation, albeit illegal,
Yeah, but then he's incriminated himself, so we can't say that his failure to have offered an alternative illegal explanation undermine or establishes that it was a related transaction.
But certainly, Your Honor, he could have also approached his lawyer could have approached our office and said, look, he disputes this $765. It was for something else. Are you willing to give him a proffer letter? Are you willing to hear him out on that in fairness in order to make sure that Judge Simon has before him the accurate facts at the sentencing hearing? And that approach was never made either, Your Honor. I realize that raises the suggestion, perhaps, as the defense argues in their brief, that there was burden shifting going on here. I don't think it does. I think it's a defendant's opportunity. The defendant has the opportunity then to object to the PSR and offer up an alternative theory and make an attempt to have protection, legal protection for any admission he might make regarding other illegal conduct, Judge. With respect to the issue of the prosecutorial vouching regarding Mr. Beagle's plea agreement, the defendant argues in his reply brief at page 13 that the government uses the plea agreement testimony to suggest that it knows facts not before the jury, and that ensures that the witness testified truthfully pursuant to the plea agreement, and as a result, improper vouching has occurred. There is absolutely no evidence in the record of that. There was never any suggestion at closing argument. There was never any argument of any kind suggesting that the government had information that was outside the record regarding Mr. Beagle's truthfulness. There was never any offer or argument by government counsel. In this case, I happen to be counsel at the trial regarding my personal belief regarding Mr. Beagle's truthfulness. So that issue, I wanted to address given the what I believe is a mistaken claim in the reply brief on that.
Now, of course, you're on, I mean, good for the government, I suppose, plain error review on these vouching claims.
Yes.
But I have to say, I'm disturbed when over and over we see statements like the risking the career statement that you've conceded went over the line. I hate the idea that these things are said with the thought, oh, we had a strong case anyway, so we'll always win on either harmless error or plain error if they don't happen to notice it. I mean, that's just an unsatisfactory state of affairs, even though, you know, I certainly understand these things don't necessarily affect the validity of the conviction.
Your Honor, I will tell you, for what it's worth, that I was unaware of this rule when I made that argument. I certainly would not have gone in there and made an improper argument thinking, well, this case is a slam dunk on the facts, so I can create error. I was not aware of it, and defense counsel, as you know, in their closing, spent several minutes really criticizing the credibility of Officer Ferry and ended up saying the drugs weren't there, it never happened. The only response that I was stuck with at that point, given the fact that this suggestion that the drugs were not there was never made during cross-examination, I didn't have any evidence in the record, and I erred. I certainly do not agree.
Actually, I don't see the error.
Yeah.
I don't see the error. If you just say, I mean, with regard to the officer, if you just say, why would he jeopardize his career by lying, I don't think you're doing anything but asking the jury to make a sort of a common sense a conjecture. You're not saying, well, it may be different if you said, look, I know this officer. He's never told a lie in his life. You know, I can tell you it's inconceivable he would have done that. You're just asking a rhetorical question. I don't see
I did frame it, Your Honor, in terms of...
I realize some cases say this is a terrible thing to do, but I don't get it. Vouching means, you know, you say, using the authority of the government, you know, I know this guy, I know the witness, I know him, I wouldn't put a witness on if I didn't believe he was telling the truth, all that stuff. But I didn't see that just in a question, just in this rhetorical question. Why would he jeopardize his career to lie about it?
Your Honor, it's nice to come here and get some support even on an issue that I thought was error, but I will point out that I did frame the argument in terms of what evidence is there that he would risk his career. I tried to put it in terms of the absence of proof regarding anything that would suggest that. But certainly, if you want to revise that rule, then I would benefit personally in this case. But I want to also note that.
Anything further, Mr. Bautista?
Your Honors, I would just like to address the argument made by government counsel that their introduction of the intricately related evidence was somehow Mr. Edwards opened that door. The determination to bring in that evidence was made before trial, and the judge made that at the request of the government. So once the government had put on its case, Mr. Edwards had to fit his strategy to what had come in by the government. So to say that the probativeness of the evidence should have been determined based upon what was later brought in by Mr. Edwards isn't the right analysis for this. We should look at what occurs at beforehand. If Mr. Edwards wasn't going to bring in this evidence, which I don't believe he would have if it could have kept out, then I think that's the better rule. And barring any further questions from the court, I would rest.
Thank you. And Mr. Bautista, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment, yours and that of your law firm, and the assistance you've been to the court as well as your client.
Thank you, Your Honors.